Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Millennial Love, a podcast from The Independent on everything to do with love, sexuality, identity and more. This week I'm joined by author and journalist Alice Vincent to discuss her excellent memoir, Rootbound, which has just come out in paperback. In the book, Alice talks about a year of her life in her late 20s when, out of nowhere, she found herself suddenly single, living out of a suitcase and trying to overcome major heartbreak. We talk about getting over a breakup quite a lot on this show, but the reason I was so keen to chat to Alice is because her method was quite unique. In short, it was plants. Obviously, it's a bit more complicated than that, but in Rootbound, Alice explores how it was through nurturing pot plants and surrounding herself with greenery that she was able to find a new lease of life in the wake of a breakup. Enjoy the show. Hi, Alice.
Hey, Libby.
How are you? How is lockdown 3.0 for you?
Wow, it is grey, isn't it? It's so grey. I'm trying to stay positive and take every day as it comes. But, you know, counting the blessings, all of that, I think it's just such a roller coaster. Like some days you're like, this is totally fine. And then others, you just kind of an inexplicable wave of sadness descends. But no, we're ticking along, keeping busy.
Yeah, I think keeping busy is the best thing to do, whether it's like running to the supermarket just to buy, I don't know, sugar or something, like every little thing. And it's important to get out as well, even though that seems like that's something that is being clamped down upon now. Like you can only exercise for an hour or something. I can't even remember what the rules are now.
Well, I mean, does anyone really know them? It seems everyone's confused about the rules. But yeah, no, I feel you. Like, my rule is essentially when it's sunny, I get out on the bike and go for as far as seems feasibly allowed. And then if it's miserable like it is today, it's okay to bunker down. I think in comparison to other lockdowns where things have been a bit more stringent, I think we've just got to really go with how we're feeling at the moment.
Yeah, totally. So today we are going to talk about lighter subjects than lockdown, thankfully. We're going to talk about your memoir, Rootbound. So can you start us off by explaining to the listeners what the book is about?
Yes, certainly. I am famously bad at explaining what the book is about, but it is essentially the story of a year in my life in my late 20s when my seemingly solid life, the nice flat I lived in, the nice partner I thought I was going to marry, the seemingly cool job that I had, everything kind of fell apart a bit and I had to forge a new way of living. And one of the things that helped me do that was by getting really into growing plants and accessing nature and reveling in the green spaces that were around me, even though I lived in London and didn't have a garden. And it also draws on the other generations of people who have gone to ground in times of trauma. And what's interesting is this book was written very much before the events of 2020, but then obviously in the spring of 2020, when lockdown first began and the pandemic happened, it was quite amazing to see people going to ground again and everyone started becoming fascinated with growing things and gardening and tending to their houseplants as a means of coping.
Yeah, it's so true. I've actually really tried to get into it myself and I need your advice because I am terrible at it. I have killed maybe 5 plants and I don't get rid of them quick enough because I'm too lazy. So I just have loads of like dead plants in my house.
It's like a tiny botanical cemetery.
Yeah, it's really uplifting. So would you mind by reading out a passage from the book? Because one of the, I think, most poignant and relatable parts is this particular moment when you describe Josh, your partner at the time, leaving. And I think it's something that people will be able to identify with quite a lot.
Sure. On the morning, it all fell apart. The skies were clear. The kind of deep and unrelenting blue that leaves the ground carved up with shadow. I was looking at it as I mindlessly spooned cereal into my mouth when Josh walked into the room and told me he wanted to go on a break, that we needed to go on a break. Minutes earlier, I had eased myself out of his sleeping arms. These events didn't make sense. I couldn't process them. I didn't want to. Perhaps he tried to explain, but I can't remember what was said. The words reached my ears distorted, as if he were talking underwater. The cereal softened in the bowl, slowly collapsing under the lapping tides of milk. I felt submerged by it all. When I came up for air, one sentence remained. I feel like I'm falling out of love with you.
Well, I just think that passage is so brilliantly written, not just because you focus on all of the details of the thoughts that kind of come in and out of your head, but the way that you really zone in on how that's the one thing that you hear the loudest, like, I think I'm falling out of love with you, because it's so blunt and so brutal and seems to just come out of nowhere. And I think that is unfortunately so common, particularly at the age that you're describing, in your late 20s, when it's like, you know, everyone talks about your Saturn return when you get to like 27, 28, and you have this huge lifestyle change. And that is when a lot of people break up. And it tends to be, like you said, the couples that you think are going to go the distance. And then it's suddenly out of nowhere, something just switches. So I really love the way that you talk about how going to the ground kind of helped you overcome the trauma of that. Would you mind talking to me a little bit more about that and just explaining what it was about nurturing plants and kind of like surrounding yourself with green that you found to be so healing?
Yeah, it wasn't even like, oh God, I feel terrible, I'm gonna garden, you know. With me, but I mean, I did all the stuff everyone does after a breakup. I went to like 10 festivals. I refused to go to bed at a civilized time. I drank way too much, you know, all that classic, like posting embarrassing selfies to Instagram. All of the normal tropes that happened. And then I'd been gardening for a while before this, it should be said, like I'd kept a little balcony garden, but that was so intrinsically tied to my sense of home, to the flat that like I could no longer live in. And that I didn't even come to my mind. I was like, that's something that stops with this relationship, so it's done. But I just kind of, once all the parties and the festivals and everything had happened and I was slightly better at being by myself with my own company, which I think is a really terrifying thing in the first wake of a breakup. If you're used to being around someone all the time or having that sleeping body next to you, like it is terrifying to confront what that is like. And once I kind of gotten over that a bit, it kind of just presented itself to me, because this all happened in late spring, early summer, which is obviously a very fertile time, and there is just like flowers were literally just blooming on my balcony without me doing anything to them. And there was a few days in the immediate aftermath of the events that I just read about, when it was also in the day that Joe Cox was killed, and everything was just so heavy, and I went out onto the balcony and this kind of these perfect poppies had bloomed in the space of the greyest day, and I thought, well, that's it, like the natural world just keeps going on, like we are part of a much wider system that will carry on, like I'm probably one of 300 people who have had their lives turned upside down today and the rest, and this is all going on anyway. And I found that so reassuring. There was a time in my life where it was very difficult to mark time or passing, and it felt both listless and I didn't have any control over anything, but nature and the natural cycles of gardening and plants were carrying on. And I kind of began to realize that if I could clock into that, that was a way of seizing control when I had an understanding, when I had none of that in the rest of my life.
It's so interesting, because so many people actually go through that cycle, like you said, in the wake of a breakup. Like there are the kind of stereotypical things that most people do, like drinking too much and making very bad decisions as sort of like a rite of passage, like cleansing ritual. But I think once you're over that, going to nature is such a intrinsic thing. And like I've had people on the show before talking about how hiking really helps them in the wake of a breakup, or surfing, or, you know, we had Victoria Pendleton on the show talking about how doing extreme sports just really helped her, because it's like showing you what your body can do. And, you know, I think with the ocean in particular as well, kind of that like vastness, and like kind of what you said about realizing that, you know, there's so much else going on that is stable and consistent. The ocean will always be there. Like the plants will always be there. It's a really, it's just a really reassuring thing.
Yeah, and it's, and as you say, it's the enormity of it. Like I was a novice, a gardener a bit, but I didn't know anything. So there was that kind of weird hobbyistic side to it as well, which was like, I want to learn more. There is a whole language I don't understand. Like I can throw myself into this kind of slightly weird, a very private fascination, because my mates weren't into gardening. So it wasn't even like, it's like, let's hang out together and do this. It was like, this is just me and me getting used to spending time with myself and my thoughts. And often it wasn't even physical gardening in my space. It was like finding parks that had beautiful landscape gardens, or looking at everyone's window boxes as I walked down one of the many new streets I slept on when I was like finding somewhere to live permanently. It was kind of finding a new way of looking at the world.
What were some of the parks and places in London that you discovered and found to be particularly healing? Because I know you write about this in the book and you mentioned it there, but it's, you know, after the breakup, you obviously didn't have anywhere to live. So like you said, you were living in various different parts of London. How long did that go on for? And then I'll go back to that parks question.
Yeah, no, it's fine. How did it go on for? Well, it was the long and the short of it is that we kind of did, we timeshared the flat, like the kind of the practicalities we were always incredibly civil and good with sorting out in quite a grown-up fashion. So essentially it would be 1 month where one of us would be in the flat and then the other person would take it. Which, and when I say it now, is like a ludicrous idea, but that's nevertheless what we settled on, and it is constantly moving. And so you know, it was things like I was flung back into Hackney for the first time in about 5 years, and so London Fields suddenly became somewhere that I went, and you know what, and places like, oh yeah, so how long did it go on for? It went on, I think by about January I was settled. So it was about 5 or 6 months.
That's a long time. And I think to feel, yeah, to feel like, to use this word, uprooted in that way is, incredibly disconcerting when you're going through all of that kind of difficulty and you're like emotionally speaking, I guess. So I can understand why like the stability of the natural world provided some comfort.
Yeah, the one that actually, and this, you know, just because I was settled by January, I still didn't get a permanent place of my own until September. So it's 15 months of being not really sure of any future, which for someone who's quite neurotic about planning was in many ways very freeing and terrifying in equal measure. But the one that I really connected to was Brockwell Park Community Gardens, which are in South London, and they're a community garden, so you know, it became like a kind of Sunday ritual for me. I would go the minute they opened on the Sunday morning, and I'd spend all morning in the winter, so this was like November through to kind of February, March, doing mostly boring heavy labor, like digging stuff and, you know, dealing with ponds, like, and weeding, like nothing fun or glamorous, but there was this kind of ritualistic sensory pleasure of being like cold and moving your body and the way it feels to breathe out warm air in the cold, like that felt somehow kind of cleansing and other, and it was really useful at the time.
You kind of touched on this earlier, but I want to ask you a bit more about it. What is it about breakups that you think can make someone kind of lose their sense of self and want to like throw themselves into a new hobby or a new passion? And do you think that's something that women tend to do more than men, and like women tend to feel that kind of loss of self? Because I mean, from my experience and from my friend's experience, that certainly seems to be the case.
It was certainly the case for me. I mean, and I wonder why that is. It's interesting when you say, do you think it's the case for men? I wouldn't know. I mean, a lot of them do a lot of stupid shit after a breakup, which would suggest that maybe it is a sense of a lot of sense of self. But like for me, I hadn't been single. So this all happened when I was 27, on the cusp of being 28. And I hadn't been single since I was 22. Like, so the key part of your 20s where you are like Tinder dating or finding your career or having different groups of friends and changing your hair and your clothes every 6 months. Like, all of that, I had been with this one really stabilizing person. And so when I wasn't with him anymore, I really was like, who am I? And not only who am I, but who do I want to be now? What parts of my life before that is no longer accessible to me do I want to take forward, and what do I not? And I do think that, I don't think I changed radically, but I did change how I kind of lived my life, and the kind of the, I guess, the things that are important to me changed a little bit. And gardening is nevertheless like a hobby. It's something that is therapeutic for me. I wouldn't say it's a personality trait, but I think it happens in breakups, because often certainly that first big relationship, happens in quite a formative time in your life anyway. I think as people, we're changing all the time. And I think when you do get to a point where your whole life and your identity is very much enmeshed in being a couple, which I think is actually something that happens a lot when you are younger, having been in like various relationships throughout my life, like when you're older, it's very refreshing coming to a new relationship when you're a bit older, because you kind of know what you're not going to stand for, having done that already. And there is that sheer infatuation with those first people, that you are just like, I'm going to stick to you, and we're going to be a we, and the excitement of being a unit, which maybe doesn't apply to anything when you're older.
Yeah. Also, I think growing up with social media also plays quite a big role in that. Like, it's very easy to make fun of all the kind of hashtag couple goals posts on Instagram, but it's a thing. People, like you said, they create these like joint identities together, and, you know, they create an image of their relationship and put it out into the world. And obviously it's never going to be a completely accurate depiction, mm-hmm. because how could it be? But it's like a part of being like, oh, this is who we are. You know, and it's almost like taking pride in that. Mm. It's interesting.
Yeah, the Instagram thing is interesting as well, because like there are, I mean, still on my private account, there are still photos from other bits of my life that aren't really relevant anymore. But not that many. Like, the vast majority of that relationship happened at a time where people were Facebook obsessed rather than Instagram obsessed. So didn't have that urge to like glow up my relationship in a social media way, which I think is a very real pressure. And like, you see some photos that people put up and with their partners, and you're like, wow, you look like you're in a magazine. Like, it's not something that I did on Instagram, on Facebook. Yeah, but fortunately everyone stopped using that now, so.
it's funny that there's so many politics with Instagram when it comes to relationships. It's something I really enjoyed writing about in Millennial Love, in my book. There's a whole chapter just on Instagram, because it's like there are so many different things. It's like, what's the difference between posting about a partner on the grid versus on your stories? And how long should you wait to post about someone? And what if they're posting about you, but you're not posting about them? And what if they haven't deleted pictures of their ex? Should you delete pictures of your ex? Like, there's so many strands to it.
I think it took me possibly, but I can remember the first time I put up a photo of me and my current partner, like, and I think we may have been going out for like 2 years at that point before I put up a photo of the pair of us on my account, because I don't know, I guess I'm an older millennial, but it also just felt like such a public declaration. And that's the other thing that happens if you come out of a breakup, and what Rootbound also talks about is what happens when you fall in love when you're really not ready to fall in love, because that's what happened after the breakup. And I was just terrified of like being, of admitting mostly to myself that I was in a new relationship.
Mm. Writing about falling in love and falling out of love is such an interesting thing to do. And that, you know, I'm saying that as someone who does it herself, because it's such a private experience. It's one of the most intimate things that you do in your life. So to make it public can seem a bit strange to someone who doesn't do it. So would you mind explaining how it helped you writing about it, and why you wanted to do that, why you wanted to make these experiences public?
It's so interesting because I'm actually a really, sounds ridiculous, like I'm a private person, like conversationally, in groups of friends, with my colleagues, I'm a private person. I got engaged in May and I didn't tell my colleagues about it because it felt weird to over Zoom. And then there was a piece in Vogue published about my engagement. They were like, hang on, did you get engaged? And I was like, yeah. And they're like, why? Are you, do you know what I mean? Like that kind of sums up, like very happy to write about it. Not so much to talk about it. And so for Rootbound, for me, it was actually I didn't even realize it at the time. It was only when I kind of spoke to people afterwards that I realized that it was incredibly therapeutic for me because I wasn't talking about these feelings. And it gave me a space to do so, albeit in a really relatively public platform.
Yeah, but it doesn't feel, that's the thing though, it's public, but it doesn't feel public because obviously when you're writing about it, you're doing it in the privacy of your own home normally, and it's just you and your computer, and it kind of just feels like you're writing in your diary or something, and then it just so happens that loads of people will read it. But I guess when you're writing it, you don't think anyone's going to read it, do you?
No, exactly. For me, it was, as it's always been, a form of like getting my thoughts in shape on a page, and the people I was most concerned about reading it were the people I know in real life, because I know that, you know, sometimes some of them will say, oh my god, I'm reading your book, and when it's like a kind of acquaintance, and I'm just like, oh, okay. But then otherwise I'll go to events and complete strangers will be like, oh, what happened with you and Matt, like, because they've read the book, and then I tell them and they're all like, oh my god, that's amazing. And do you know what I mean? That is to talk to strangers about it is wholly fine.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com. Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Did you talk to Josh about writing the book? Did he know? What was that kind of process like?
It was something that was very, very present in my mind the entire time I was writing it.
I bet.
Because contrary to what it might seem, like, it's not an easy thing to do. Like, we had, as I wrote about in the book, an amicable, mature, kind breakup. It was painful for everyone, but it was not acrimonious. And so then to do something like this might be seen to be really problematic. And I totally understand that. But nevertheless, it's my story. There are a few things I did that I hoped would protect him, namely changing the name, making him a relatively unrecognizable person, not really talking much about our relationship, glossing over certain things that happened in the wake of it, but which is kind of how I legitimized it. To answer your question, once the edit was done on the book, which is when like a book can totally change, I told him about it. Although he had caught wind of it before and was like, what's going on? And then I explained my reasoning, and I think we were kind of all square on that. I felt that we had reached a point of kind of not permission because I wasn't seeking it, but a kind of, you know, cool, like we were chill. I don't know kind of what's happened next, to be honest, but it is a huge thing to do, and it's still something that I think about, because whenever you're writing about a memoir, that is the kind of ethical and moral quandary behind it. Like, there are real people in this book, some are named, some not so much, and what is it like for them?
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing. I think I spoke to Elizabeth Day about this quite a lot when she wrote her memoir, when she wrote How to Fail. And I asked her because she had some quite difficult breakups that she talked about in the book. And I remember asking her if she had told the men that she was including them in the book. And they weren't as in-depth as how you've written about Josh. It was kind of just like little stories here and there. And she said, no, I haven't. Because frankly, fuck them. She said that much more eloquently. Yeah. But she basically said, you know what? It's my story. I own my story. I own what happened to me. And I have a right to share it. And, you know, like you said, it's about being really careful about the way that you write it. And it's about not trying to, you know, insert your voice into their story and trying to focus on, you know, how it happened through your eyes and how it affected you. Because, you know, it's your book. It's not about them, you know. You're using them as a vehicle to tell your own story.
Yeah. And it should also be said at this point that, like, Matt, who is my current partner, is definitely gets more airtime in this. And he was, like, remarkably chill about the entire thing.
This is what I wanted to ask you about next. So the second half of the book obviously focuses on you falling in love with Matt, your now fiancé. So for those who haven't read Rootbound, could you tell us how you guys met?
Yeah, we met at a party. We met at a party that had been organised by some mutual friends. And I nearly didn't go to that party and neither did he.
Sorry to interrupt you, but that always happens, isn't it? It's always like, oh, I nearly didn't go.
And I'd gone to meet a friend and we'd had a lot of wine at dinner and the restaurant was really close to the party. So we thought, oh, fuck it, let's go. And he went because he'd been out in Suffolk all day on a job or something. Anyway, I think it's fair to say that we were probably both looking for the same thing, even though we'd not met each other before, which is that, like, frankly, it'd been a bit of a dry summer. So I think it was just like, oh, okay, like, this is good timing. And I genuinely never thought I'd see him again after that evening. But evidently we did see one another again, so.
and you touched on this earlier, but how does he feel about the book? You know, he, like you said, he is mentioned much more than Josh, obviously, yeah. And features much more prominently. So how did he feel about it? At what point did you let him read it?
The thing is that he's not anymore, but he was a writer. He's changed his career now, but he was very much a catalyst in the book's existence, in the sense that I really distinctly remember him kind of sitting me down on a Victoria Line tube train and being like, you have to write this book because I want to read it. But I think I've just been whiffling on. You're writing a book, like, you're like, oh God, well, I can't do it. Oh, but I want to. And I think he just had enough. He's like, you have to write it. And I think that was a bit of the permission granting I needed. And with regards to him, I mean, I think he thinks he comes off really well, which he does, honestly. So I think he's kind of fine with it. I've always thought it would be quite interesting, you know, by the time that the book came out, I still, after, especially having been through such a savage breakup, I don't take anything for granted. Even now, like, we've decided to get married, like, there's every chance that we might break up. And then there is this very well documented narrative of us falling in love. That's something I've thought about quite a lot.
That's interesting, because it also goes back to a little bit to what we were saying about social media, about putting photos up when you're in a relationship and then having that record if that relationship dissolves. It's like, it's a little bit of an uncomfortable thing, because it's like, well, you can't just delete your past. I mean, you can delete Instagram photos, you can't delete a book. But it's a difficult thing, isn't it?
Yeah, the way I kind of made peace with it is the fact is the way I've made peace with a lot of other things in the book, which is that and authors say this a lot, which is that the book is kind of an active thing while you're writing it, and then once it's published, it's not really yours to hang on to anymore. Like, it exists, people read it, some of them will know who I am. Like, life kind of happens. So,
and I guess you also have to think, like, you know, there's comfort in knowing there's the circle of people who know you compared to the number of people who will read your book. It's probably quite small.
Yeah. Well, one would hope.
Yeah, hopefully. It's not just your friends and family that read the book.
My mum's bought 10 copies. Yeah. Well, exactly. And I feel like the people who do know me, like, if we were to no longer be together, that I hope their thoughts would be beyond, oh, well, you wrote a giant book about him, and now I hope they'd be more like, oh, babe, are you okay?
We have to wrap up, but before we go, it's time for our Lessons in Love segment of the show. So this is the part of the podcast where I ask every guest to share something that they've learned from their previous relationships. So Alice, what is your lesson in love for us today?
I've cheated a bit, and I've learned this as much from my current relationship as from my previous ones. But I've been thinking about it, and I think what I would say is that I've learned that love, to be in love, is a choice that someone makes daily. You wake up and you make that choice, unconsciously or otherwise, every single day. And I think that the problems start to set in when you start taking things for granted, and when you maybe stop making that choice. It's a choice as conscious or unconscious as deciding whether to have a shower or a bath or whether to make a cup of tea or not, but it's nevertheless, it's an active thing.
I love that. That's so important to remember, and something that you really don't hear very often, because that's not how love is presented in popular culture, for example. It's kind of like something that just happens to you. And that's so not the reality whatsoever. It kind of suggests that, you know, it's you don't have to work at it. And of course you do.
Yeah, this is it. It's a choosing. And some days it's easier to choose than others, I guess.
Yeah. And the taking someone for granted as well, I think it's, do you think that's something that happens, I guess, at a certain point in every relationship, after you've been together for a certain number of years or months, because you're so used to one another, it becomes quite difficult not to kind of get so used to them being there. You almost forget to choose them.
Yes, I think that's when the rot sets in, really, is that there's, for me, especially after the events of the book, I was kind of hugely allergic to comfort. And I was terrified that to be comfortable with someone would inevitably mean a kind of decline in in quality of relationship, when obviously a lot of people crave that comfort. And I'm not. And now, a few years on, I've learned that comfort is wonderful and it is a sign of solidity, but you still have to, it's still really important to choose to do those things. Like, every morning I will have a cup of tea made for me and asked, would you like a cup of tea? And it's a ridiculous and largely unnecessary question, but I love that it is done, that, like, it is an active decision. And I make just as many in the other way. I do think it's important to remember what you've got.
That's it for today. Thank you so much for listening. If you're a new listener to Millennial Love, you can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or anywhere else. You can comment and leave us a rating too, so that more people can find us. Keep up to date with everything to do with the show on Instagram. Just search Millennial Love. See you soon!